Du lytter til Hestedølærerne. Podcasten for dig, der er dølæge eller veterinærsygeplejerske og arbejder med heste. Mit navn er Emma Thomsen. Jeg er dølæge og arbejder som konsulent for Børinger Ingelheim. I Hestedølærerne taler vi om tilstanden og sygdommen, der kan ramme heste, men vi tager også andre emner op, som er relevante for dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Denne podcast er lavet af Børinger Ingelheim, og med denne podcast ønsker vi at give noget tilbage til dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Vi ønsker at tage emner op, som er interessante og relevante for dig, og hvis du har forslag til emner, du gerne vil høre mere om, eller tips til en gæst, du gerne vil høre, så tøv ikke med at kontakte os. Mine kontaktoplysninger finder du i podcastens beskrivelse.
Welcome back to this series of episodes where we are talking with Dr. Ingrid Verfurt from the University of Leipzig in Germany. Ingrid is an equine nutritionist, and she is invited by us to talk about nutritional issues and concerns in horses. And in this episode, we want to talk a little bit more about minerals, vitamins, and electrolytes, because I think there are a lot of questions and conceptions surrounding these topics that we want to cover. So the first question I actually have to both you, Ingrid, and to Louise, and you can both answer it from your respective sort of horizon or experience. How common is it to actually see vitamin or mineral deficiencies or toxicities in horses caused by the ingredients of the feed or the forage? If we start with you, Ingrid, how common is it?
Okay, I think when horses are under a forage-based diet, then we see from our data that the forage is low in copper, zinc, selenium, and iodine. So when we don't add extra minerals into the diet, then for long term it might be a problem, for example, to have a zinc deficiency and also selenium. For other trace elements such as iron or manganese, we don't see these problems. So there are sufficient amounts in the forages. And when we look to the major elements, we can see it depends really on the on the type of forage. We may have low or even very high calcium levels. And what I see in the last 2 years, but it's more on a general basis, that the phosphorus level, there's a kind of decrease, and that may be a problem for growing horses, that at least some of the minerals do not provide sufficient phosphorus, meanwhile, because we didn't expect that the phosphorus level will decrease. We have always very high potassium levels, so that's not a big issue. Magnesium, yeah, sometimes we have sufficient magnesium levels in the forage and sometimes not. It depends a little bit on the quality of the hay, on the soil and the area. And also the sodium level will be extremely low in forage, so we need to add some salt into the diet. And I also see in the last 2 years that the sulfur, that is a drop in the sulfur in the forages, so we have maybe to consider the sulfur intake a little bit more than we did in the past. Yeah, that is my general impression of the forage quality and the intake of major and trace elements.
And then maybe I can give my perspective as a clinician. So fortunately, in our part of the world, in the Nordic countries, it's been very rare for me to see clinical cases of feed deficiencies. Most often it seems to be subclinical, that we when we do the math on the feeding regimens, then we can see that there are deficits. And we know that many of these vitamins and minerals, they are coenzymes in the cellular processes. So we know that we need to optimize it. But fortunately, we rarely see clinical syndromes, except for maybe the growth problems in the younger foals and so forth. So many of the things that we read about in the textbooks of these types of deficiencies or toxicities, we're fortunate enough to not see clinically. And many of the syndromes in horses have not even been described, but it's a something that we know exists in other animals, and we need to optimize the feeding balances to make sure that we still don't see it. So, for instance, problems with what we know as big head disease, where the calcium phosphor is abnormal, that's in the third world countries. So obviously that's what we all fear. But because we have such excellent nutritional advice and the feedstuffs that we can buy here, the way that we produce our hays and so forth makes it very rare for us to in fact see clinical cases. Toxicities are another thing that's where we need to make sure that we don't oversupplement, but fortunately it's extremely rare that we see. It's more of an accidental ingestion of a large volume of certain things. So we need to stay tuned on the balances, because we know that if they have deficiencies or imbalances, we can see subclinical things that could affect the performance of the horse and so forth. So
Yeah, and I guess the subclinical deficiencies could also have consequences long term, even if it doesn't end up in an acute situation. It could potentially have consequences, so it still needs to be monitored and taken into
Absolutely.
consideration. And we want to we have some particular substances that we wanted to discuss a little bit more in depth. And that is iron, zinc, biotin, and vitamin E. And if you would like to address any other specific vitamins or minerals that you think is important, then we're happy to talk about that as well. But if we start with iron, how well do horses tolerate an excess of iron? Because I think it's pretty common that we have pretty rich iron, at least in the Nordic countries, we have a lot of iron in the hay. I think it's the same in Germany. And also, lots of vitamin supplements, strangely enough, are usually also supplemented with iron. So if you do the calculation, then a ration could come up with an iron intake of several 100% of the requirement. How is this tolerated by horses? Is this something that we need to think about more?
Yeah, I think with the iron, it's a little bit complex. So when the iron comes from the forages, then it is formulated in a way that the horses will not absorb the iron from the intestine into the bloodstream. So, and it's very efficient not to absorb iron, because otherwise we won't have any horses anymore. But if you have a high iron level in the forages, you should think about the way you harvest your forages, because it's the contamination by the soil, and then you should discuss it that the way is not really a proper way, because if you put a lot of iron or a lot of soil into the forage, it makes the forage not better. So you should be aware that it's a problem, but it's not a iron toxicity. So that is one point. So there's sufficient iron in the diet, but fortunately the horses will not absorb it. And there's one scientific paper that showed when the iron requirement is a little bit higher, then the horses can direct the absorption and increase it a little bit. So that is from the typical foragers. Iron is a problem, but because of the in my opinion, not very well harvesting conditions, but it's not the iron toxicity. However, when we look to the supplements, there are a lot of iron supplements. The iron is bounded to a amino acid, for example, and then the iron will be absorbed, because the transport mechanism is done by the amino acid transporters. And then it is at least in foals, in young horses, a big problem, because the foals have a very low capacity to bind the iron and to bring it into tissues where it is more or less safe. So, and therefore, it is really not a very good advice to supplement any iron to growing foals. It is really dangerous, because the foals have no really capacity to get rid of the extra iron, and you can produce a lot of problems such as kidney diseases or kidney failure by high iron intake. So for me, if I'm asked by Kurt, for example, so there was an iron supplementation by a newborn foal, what would you recommend? I would say that is really a mistake by the veterinarian or by the horse owner. I'm very clear about that. In adult horses, it makes no sense at all because of the high iron content in the forages. But adult horses are more able to get rid of the extra iron because they have the binding capacity by certain proteins in the blood, and then they can store it in the liver. But it makes really no sense. Another point is when you add, for example, in a growing foal, extra iron, and the foal suffer, for example, from an infection disease, because a lot of bacteria, they need iron for their metabolism. And when you put extra more iron into the foal, these bacteria will use the iron. So it is really, it makes no sense, and it is really dangerous. Therefore, we should be very clear with the extra iron. And maybe one another comment, the milk of the mare is low in iron, and we should think about it. It is nature, and there might be some benefits why the milk is low of iron, because the young animals cannot cope the high amounts of iron. And therefore, so we should be very clear. And sometimes people that took a blood sample and they found a low iron in the blood doesn't tell you anything about the iron intake, because the metabolism try to compensate a high iron intake. And when you have an anemia, for example, then you should think about it where the anemia comes. It's more maybe like a kidney disease, but it's not an anemia because of a low iron intake. So that is, we should be very clear about that. And sometimes we have high iron levels or higher iron levels in the drinking water. However, again, you will not cause an iron toxicity, but the palatability can be somewhat lower in those water qualities with a high iron load. But sometimes horses even prefer to drink water which looks not very nice, but some horses don't like it, so we should think about it. But it's not the risk of iron toxicity by those iron sources which come from the soil, etc.
So just to summarize again, because I think this is one of the topics that people are a little bit concerned about when they take their blood samples and they get the low iron. And if they see at the same time a low red blood cell count, then they would automatically start supplementing with iron supplementation. And we hear that you say that that is most likely not the reason for an anemia. So how should they interpret a low iron on their blood samples then?
Honestly, I would recommend not to measure blood iron anymore. So that would be the easiest way. And then if, for example, there's an anemia, you should check what might be the reason for the anemia. Is it a parasite load? Is it a kidney disease or another disease? Or is it a response to very high iron load that the metabolism try to get rid of the high iron by to use, for example, the liver as a storage tissue? So it makes no sense to look to the iron levels in blood, because the interpretation is always wrong. So I would really recommend not to provide this tool anymore. That is more for the labs, but it would be very important to exclude this parameter from the routine screening.
We do see sometimes in severe infection that the iron kind of get harvested inside cells, and it's kind of like an acute phase response. But for feeding purposes and whether or not to supplement with iron, then iron status in the blood is not a very good marker. What about if you see excess iron in the blood?
Can I just recommend, because when the iron is load during an infection. That is a typical response, which I would like, or which I explained, maybe not in the correct way, because when there's an inflammation, we know that the iron will turn from the bloodstream into the tissue of inflammation because the bacteria will use it. Therefore, it makes no sense to supplement iron because it's or I mean the body may have two possibilities. They can get rid of the iron to store it in a tissue without any inflammation, or because to prevent that bacteria can use the iron. So it makes no sense to add iron because it could be a kind of marker of an acute inflammation, but I don't know if it's really the best marker because we have other markers of inflammation, but we see it frequently to have a high serum amyloid A level and an extremely low iron level. But that in it is most likely that the iron will enter the area of inflammation, and then it makes no sense to add extra iron.
And what about if you ever see iron in excess on your blood sample?
There is some case, or there is a case report from the Netherlands, and in that case report, they reported that there was excessive iron in the surrounding, and the horses suffered from an intoxication, mainly by the tissue damage, like the liver or the kidneys. So there's one case report. I think it was in the Netherlands. Personally, I have never seen an iron intoxication, but it's one report and it's published in the EVJ. So, but I still have some problems to understand the intoxication, and I'm still convinced that there were other factors which may have an impact on the outcome. The cases are rare, but I think it's more the secondary problems that we have more iron, for example, in the tissues for the bacteria. So that is more of concern. But honestly, I have never seen an iron intoxication in a horse.
Well, I have seen, but it's very specific for foals that you give blood transfusion, and if they
Okay.
hemolyze, then you give an overdose of iron, like an acute overdose because of your hemolysis. And that's the only cases that I've seen where I truly believe that it's an iron. And then you can give medication to bind the iron, but it's a long road ahead, and they usually are pretty severe, these cases. But I would say as well that for the adult horses, I've never seen over supplementation with some like we can give them in an adult horse. It seems to
No,
go
no.
through the excreted, but in the foals, if you see a high iron, then it's probably significant clinically, while the low iron is very useless, I
Yeah,
guess.
that's what I tried to explain in the beginning, that the foal is not able to cope a lot of iron, and therefore it's really dangerous to supplement. But honestly, the good point is that most supplements which are used to increase the iron intakes, they are so low in iron, although they are claimed or labeled to improve iron intake. So the iron levels are so low. So I think they are, besides that, I think they are useless. They are not dangerous because the iron level is so low. But yeah.
Perfect. But how should I then approach the situation? Let's say I have a good quality forage. It just happens to be very high in iron, and I can probably conclude that it's not likely due to contamination because I know the harvest methods has been good and so forth. So it's good in it's high in iron, but good otherwise. And then I have a mineral supplement which balances the hay good. But it also has added iron. Should I then look for another mineral supplement, or can I go with this one safely? Because then I will have an iron excess in the intake, but the other minerals sort of are balanced and so on. Because I find it hard to find actually mineral supplements that are balanced for balancing hay without iron or with low iron. It's difficult.
Actually, we have one supplement on the market in Germany without iron. That is interesting. However, wouldn't really to be too concerned about high iron level in the forage, because we are quite sure that the absorption is really, really low. So, and if you add some extra iron from the supplement, so this iron will be absorbed, and the iron from the forage will not be absorbed. So it's not really a big problem. So because it's more problem to get a mineral supplement without any iron. So yeah, of course we have one I can recommend, but mostly I recommend a mineral supplement which also contain at least some iron levels, and I'm not really concerned out because of horses can really cope the iron absorption from the forages, and if the iron is extremely high, they will not absorb the iron. So you can use a mineral supplement which also contain at least some iron. Maybe there's one point we should consider. Sometimes when we feed an aged horse with hay cubes and corn cubes and sugar beet pulp, this mixture, so the iron intake can be quite low, because the hay cubes, there might be the harvesting conditions might be a little bit different, or even the grass pellets, so the iron content might be quite low, and we have a soaking, etc., etc. So at least in aged horses, I always have a look. Of course, most of the supplements have iron. So that could be one condition where the iron intake could be quite low. And therefore, you must be make sure that the mineral supplement should contain at least some of the iron, because of the these type of forage feed to aged horses might be very low in iron. But that is really an ex in one exception. Yeah.
Then next on the list is zinc. This is something that is usually quite low in normal forage, not always adequate, and might have to be added. And as I said, I mean, a common practice is to have a forage which balance with one balancer, and that is probably optimal from a also from a financial perspective, and simplicity. And then many of the mineral supplements, of course, do contain adequate amounts of zinc. But what would be the consequences, or what can be the consequences, if we are feeding too little zinc, if we're not feeding adequate amount of zinc?
Yeah, I mean, a low zinc intake might be related to either to skin problems. So that could be we have a certain disease, parakeratosis, which is a zinc deficiency, but it could be also very unspecific changes in the skin. And then zinc is also an enzyme which is integrated in several enzymes, for example, which are involved in the carbohydrate metabolism, etc., etc. So it might be very unspecific, a low zinc intake, so that sometimes we are not really sure. And then we have, of course, another point. It might be horses with a summer eczema, but we know from these horses, even when the zinc intake is along the recommendation, they suffer from severe skin problems, and in that cases we recommend a much higher zinc intake than for healthy horses. So we have to look a little bit what is the situation, but I think a very low zinc intake in healthy horses can be very unspecific, and therefore we always try to have a good zinc intake. And some people also claim that hoof problems might be related to a low zinc intake. That is also, it's not just the zinc, to be honest, but sometimes it's also related with a low zinc intake, but it's also related with a low biotin intake or a low sulfur intake. So it's very complex, but that could be also a sign of a very low zinc intake. But again, I would like to mention that the blood tests are probably not very or do not really reflect the zinc intake, because we have quite often a low zinc level in the serum, but we have a high zinc intake. So it could be that there is no really correlation between the zinc intake and the serum levels. But I also think it could be also the fact that we don't use the correct tubes to sample or for the trace element analysis, because there must be a specific tube for the blood sampling, otherwise the zinc will be binded to the plastic, for example, and then it cannot be measured. So first I would really like to start to say, do I have the right tube for the trace element analysis? Not all labs provide the right tubes, so it should be really a specific tube. And when you use the right tubes, in most cases, the problem with the low zinc is solved. Then we have to ask, is really zinc integrated in the serum, or is it more integrated in the blood? Because zinc is always part of different enzymes, and you find these in the blood, in the whole blood. But most of the labs are not interested to use whole blood for analysis because it's very difficult. I think it's more that we have more problems with the pre-analytic procedure than that the low zinc level really reflect a low zinc intake. Another point, it's also important for me, if you decide to use a mineral supplement or a hoof supplement, please look to the zinc source, because the zinc oxide, the availability of the zinc oxide is pretty low. If you want to use it to buy a horse product for a hoof product, for example, look if it is a zinc oxide. If it is a zinc oxide, I won't buy this product. So you should look, is it a zinc binded to, for example, to an amino acid, we say an organic source, or even this zinc sulfate, which is also an inorganic source, is also the availability is quite good. So there are a lot of things which may induce a low serum zinc levels, but we should start much more to think about the pre-analytic procedure. And if we have coped this problem, then maybe we should start again or reset and say, okay, if we have done it in a proper way, do we really have low zinc levels in the blood, and can we correlate it to the zinc intake? But in the moment, most labs do not provide, in my opinion, the correct tubes. And maybe the blood or the zinc should be analyzed not in the serum, it should be analyzed in the blood, in the whole blood.
So, and then if we do decide to go ahead and supplement with zinc specifically, are there any risks at overdosing with zinc?
It's always a discussion if there's an interaction between zinc, a high zinc intake, and the copper availability. There are some data in growing foals that a high zinc intake may decrease the copper availability. However, in normal ration, and I do a lot of ration formulation, maybe I've seen one or two ration where the zinc intake was so high that there might be an interaction with the copper. But in normal ration, even if you add some more extra zinc, so we won't have this negative consequences on the copper intake. So, but that is the discussion. And another point is, zinc is it is a trace element, but it's a heavy metal, and zinc is also quite negative for our surroundings in the soil. So, and it disturbs a little bit the environment. Therefore, it makes no sense to add extra zinc without having really a reason. And for me, the only reason I have to add extra zinc into the diet is the summer eczema, because we see that there they might have a higher need for some extra zinc, and that the skin healing will be improved. But that is one exception. But normally, just to say, it doesn't matter. So it's just I want to add some more extra zinc to feel much more happier. Please, you have also to consider that what those elements which are not needed in the metabolism, they will be in our surrounding, and at least zinc is quite negative for our climate.
Well, I think that makes sense. And talking about zinc might have something to do with hoofs and health of the hoofs. Let's turn to the vitamins, and specifically the biotin. What are your thoughts about the biotin supplementation and hoof and skin issues?
normally the microflora in the intestine produce their own biotin, so the endogenous biotin. So normally horses are well or get a lot of or get biotin at least. There is some discussion if the biotin synthesis by the microflora might be changed in those horses which have problems with their hoofhorn quality. And there are some studies who have shown that the biotin levels are lower in those horses who have problems with the hoofhorn. So from that point, it makes sense to have extra biotin in hoof products. But when you look to typical mineral feeds, they also have biotin. So sometimes it's not necessary if you have a good mineral which has also vitamins, then in many cases it's not necessary to add an extra hoof supplement because we have sufficient minerals and biotin already in the mineral supplement. But if you really want to use a hoof supplement, so to have zinc as a zinc sulfate or bind it as an to an amino acid and the biotin, that makes sense.
And it's not a quick fix, I know, for the hoofs to get improved the quality. How long would you say that we should wait until we see some improvement in hoof
When
quality?
it's just related to nutrition, it takes up to 6 to 12 months where you can see any changes. But honestly, it's not just nutrition, because in most cases the horses are really well supplemented. We have much more an over supplementation than an under supplementation. So it is also the management, it could be the genes, etc. etc. So it's a very complex topic, and it's not just the nutrition. But if it's just based, for example, lack in biotin, then it takes up to at least 1 year where you can see really progress.
Yeah. So biotin supplements may have its place sometimes, but I guess your message when it comes to supplementation in general is to think really through do we really need this? And also to look at the analytics of the other feedstuffs you're giving.
Yes, that's a point. Yep.
We spoke a little bit about vitamin E in the episode with Older Horse. And we wanted to go a little bit more in depth with this vitamin. It's a fat-soluble vitamin, and it is also something that can be a little bit deficient in grass, right? It's and also in hay is usually not adequate amounts. So tell us a little bit more about vitamin E and when you think it should be considered to supplement with.
Yeah, I totally agree that in forages which are stored more than 6, 10 weeks, so there's a significant decrease in vitamin E. Therefore, there's really need, especially in those periods where the horses have no access to pasture, that we have to add extra vitamin E. And also, you also mentioned the pasture. Yeah, when we have a really hot summer, which is really dry, then we can't expect any or high amounts of vitamin E in the grass. So vitamin E is really an issue. And there's a new paper which has been published, let's say, a few weeks ago. And there is really that the vitamin E intake is by foragers is really low in horses. So that is really one point, and it's for me really a big issue. We also see that in some muscle diseases, but also in infection diseases, that there's a high need for vitamin E. Therefore, there are really reason to add a vitamin E or to put much more vitamin E into the diet than we maybe usually do. Then it's always a debate, shall we use a natural vitamin E source or a synthetic vitamin E source? Yes, most of the studies show at least some information or have some information that the natural vitamin E is much more available than the synthetic vitamin E. However, there are also data that synthetic vitamin E is also available. However, it takes a little bit longer. So if you want to have progress already, after one day, you can see when you add natural vitamin E into the diet and you measure one day later the vitamin E level in the serum, you have a huge increase. But that doesn't mean anything, in my opinion, because you don't know if there really is already a transfer into the muscle, etc. So again, I know that all that, yes, natural vitamin E is much more available, but at least even synthetic vitamin E is also available. So, but if I have the choice, of course, the first choice is to use a natural vitamin E source. But for me, much more important is to have sufficient amounts of vitamin E, because in the supplementary feed, sometimes the vitamin E level is pretty low, because vitamin E is a very expensive vitamin E. So we have to consider it. And normally, if I do, for example, ration formulation in an exercising horse, but also in an aged horse, I always use a single vitamin E source. And of course, I also recommend natural vitamin E. For me, I recommend, let's say, for example, in a healthy horse, in a leisure horse, it's about, I should provide in the total ration up to 2 milligram vitamin E per kilogram body weight. If I have a performance horse on a higher level, I recommend 3 milligram vitamin E per kilogram body weight. And if I have a horse with muscle problems, I'm up to 5 milligram vitamin E per kilogram body weight. And if I have a horse with a equine motor neuron disease, which is not a disease which is frequently seen, but we have some cases, then there are recommendations up to 8 to 10 milligram vitamin E per kilogram body weight. But here we have also some information that the absorption rate is really low. We have to think about it's not just natural vitamin E. It could be also micellized vitamin E forms. So, but it's very specific. But vitamin E, I think it's really a topic, and we should consider that forages are really low in vitamin E, and that we have to add vitamin E. Yeah.
And how can I, as a veterinarian, see on the actual product whether it's natural vitamin E or synthetic vitamin E? I guess my point is doesn't the feedstuffs that add natural, they would put that on the label because it's like a quality stamp.
But sometimes they divide it and they have a small amount now of a natural one and a higher amount of the synthetic one. But most, if you have a single vitamin E source, most of them use a natural vitamin E.
Okay. Yeah. Another comment that I would add is for the equine motor neuron disease, because initially in this episode I said that I rarely see as a clinician clinical cases, but this is in fact the vitamin E is in fact one of those that we do see infrequently, I would say. But it's typically the classic equine motor neuron disease horse would be a competition horse. In a country where they travel around and never see fresh grass, they are fed with the storage hay or silage or something that's been stored for a while and lost its vitamin E and never see green grass. That would be the classical patient for equine motor neuron disease. And then we, of course, see variations here in the Nordics when they do have access to green grass at certain times of the year. But then through the winter time, then we have this decrease in vitamin E, I guess.
Yes and no. But there's also one paper they have published, horses on the same pasture.
Oh, yeah.
They are healthy. They have much higher vitamin E levels in the serum in comparison to those who suffer from EMND, because they have quite extremely low vitamin E level besides the same vitamin E intake. I totally agree that horses which are not on pastures, they have really a problem with vitamin E deficiency. But EMND, I'm not quite sure if there is something else behind it, that the absorption is different or it's lower in comparison to healthy horses. They compared different horses on the same pasture, and that was really interesting to see. I'm not a clinician, therefore, but from my explanation, I think there is something else in the EMND, just the lack of vitamin E intake.
Yeah.
Or they respond quite well to a vitamin E supplementation, but it must be extremely high, and therefore I think there is also a deficiency in the absorption rate.
Yeah. But if you consider like the normal horse that goes to pasture in the summer, would it be safe to say that if we provide them added vitamin E during the time when it's not on green grass, that would be sufficient? Or would you play it safe and supplement throughout the whole year?
I think when you have really fresh grass and there's sufficient amount of grass, then normally grass provides sufficient amounts of vitamin E. But if you have a really hot summer and no grass at all, then of course, horses are on pasture, but the grass intake is very low. Then you should also provide vitamin E when the horses are on this kind of pasture. But it depends really. And then I think in spring and you have really fresh grass, then there's sufficient amounts of vitamin E. But the good thing is if you also add some extra vitamin E, although the horses are on pasture, we don't see any negative health consequences. So even an over supplementation seems to be pretty safe according to vitamin E. So if you want to be really sure and you have no idea about the vitamin E levels in the grass, you can provide a mineral which also contains vitamin E.
I think it's super relevant to those horses with the laminitic issues and insulin dysregulation issues that can't really go to pasture, or if they can access pasture is low quality and so on.
Yes.
So
So I
thank
think that
you.
is very good information to say when the horses have no access to pasture, then extra vitamin E must be by a complementary feed or by a single vitamin E source, etc., etc., because forage does not have or does not contain sufficient amounts of vitamin E. I think we are all pretty sure about this point, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of time through the winter time here in the Nordic countries where the horses have very limited access to any types of green grass, and they're dependent on having forage that's been stored for maybe sometimes even several months. And that's the risk for this. So how do you recommend the veterinarians to monitor vitamin E levels in the particular horses?
Of course, I always recommend to do a ration formulation or just look to the supplements about the amounts of vitamin E and the vitamin E levels in serum are pretty good to show if there are sufficient vitamin E in the diet or not. I think there's a quite good correlation between the vitamin E level in the blood and the vitamin E intake, but of course, I come from nutrition. I always recommend to have a look to the supplements and the vitamin E levels.
Very good.
Can I add
Oh,
one comment to
please.
vitamin A?
Hey,
Because
yes.
it is the same problem with the vitamin E. If horses are on a forage-based diet, the carotene, which is the precursor of vitamin A, will be degraded during storages. And therefore, we really recommend during winter time to add either carrots, for example, or to add a mineral supplement which contain vitamin A, because we know this data much more from cattle that there's a significant drop in vitamin A by the low forage quality. So that is also very important. It's quite similar to the vitamin E. Fresh grass contains sufficient amounts of carotene and which can be converted into vitamin A. But in wintertime, it's the same. You should add either carrots or really a mineral supplement which contains vitamin A. So it's pretty the same. Don't forget it because it's maybe in former times we always said, oh, there's sufficient amounts of carotene in grass, but we have few changes, and especially for the North European countries, the horses do not have so much access to pasture, so it's quite important to add this vitamin. Another point, I totally agree. We don't see too many intoxications by a high trace element intake or by a high vitamin intake. But there's, in my opinion, one exception. It's the vitamin D. At least in Germany, we have a lot of vitamin D containing supplements on the market, and I will name it. It is a bone care. It contains huge amounts of vitamin D. And it's labeled, it's also vitamin K in it, but it's labeled to improve bone metabolism. And I have seen in the last 2 or 3 years several cases with a increased calcification of the soft tissues by adding bone care, because most people do not realize when they add the bone care, because it's labeled as vitamin K, but it also contains vitamin D. And they add a mineral supplement, which may contain high amounts of vitamin D and maybe an extra complementary feed. And I have sometimes vitamin D levels in the ratio more than 30,000 units. And the requirement is, let's say, for an adult horse is between 3,000 and 4,000 vitamin units. And if you have 30,000, then you have a soft tissue calcification, and I have seen it. So that is, for me, really the oversupplementation of vitamin D is really a risk factor.
Yeah. So something that one should be cautious about then. I think it's always a little bit scary with the supplements that contain very few ingredients, like not the full mineral vitamin, because if you it's much easier to oversupplement something if that's the only thing you give, like a supplement with a very high concentration of a few elements. So I always think that one should be careful about those and probably only give it if it's recommended by a veterinarian
No,
who's
the
been.
bone there is recommended by
Oh.
veterinarians, and I don't agree with it because I've seen these cases, and they are not aware that vitamin D is already sufficient in a mineral supplement, and the
Yeah.
vitamin K, I mean, the scientific data, I know that they all claim, oh, we have data about it. There's a guy from Australia. However, if you look to the papers, I'm not really convinced that there is a lack of vitamin K in growing horses or even in adult horses, which may have a cyst. So for this product, I don't really, and it is recommended by veterinarians. So I'm very strict with this product because
Yeah.
I've seen these cases.
Yeah, I
Good
can
to know.
understand
Good to
that.
know.
Yeah, and also it sort of emphasizes the importance of evaluating the whole ration and
Yes,
not
that's the
only
point. Yeah.
recommending one supplement to for one issue, but to really evaluate the whole everything that is being given. It's a very good point. So moving on, we had a little bit about electrolytes that we wanted to ask you about as well, because electrolytes are, I would say, highly fashionable, or electrolyte supplements are highly fashionable among some types of horse owners that believe that the horses that do a lot of exercise, they need a lot of electrolyte supplements. And then on the other hand, you have those who say that the only thing that you actually need to supplement is sodium chloride or salt, because potassium is very high in the forage. So help us to clear this one out. Is electrolyte supplements, do we need them or not?
It's interesting to hear that in the northern European countries, the people want to add electrolytes. It's maybe by Anna Janssen. She did a lot of research. So in Germany, it's completely the opposite. They are all afraid to add electrolytes into the
Oh.
diet. And that's interesting to hear that there are really different ways to supplement. So first, I would like. Well, I agree totally with you that we just need the sodium and chloride. Maybe we just need the sodium because the grasses, they contain high potassium levels, but sometimes they also contain high chloride levels. So actually, we are talking a little bit more about the sodium, but salt is sodium chloride, and it is still the easiest way to supplement. So we have different possibility. We have the horse, or we can use the so-called salt lick, which just contains the sodium chloride. But we know that when horses are really on a high performance level and they sweat, then the voluntary intake of salt from the salt block is very low. So then we have to add some extra salt. And then we have horses, they do not sweat, then they do not need extra salt because most of the sodium is lost by the sweat, and if they do have no sweating, so they have just a very low requirement. So that is, for me, quite simple. However, when we have horses on a high performance level, we recommend to adapt horses to a salt intake, because if you start, let's say, with 50 gram of salt, the horses will not consume it because it's less palatable. So that is, but it's maybe it's more the way how we introduce the salt. But I'm not really concerned to add too much salt into the diet, because, or unless the horses have sufficient water. So that is for me the most danger. It's dangerous, because if they travel with the horse and the horse has no access to water and they added a lot of electrolytes, then the horses cannot compensate the high sodium intake, and then you may have a kind of salt intoxication. That is the main concern. But if you add some extra salt, although it's not necessary, then the horses will drink a little bit more water, and that is not a big problem. In former times, we recommended, for example, salt intake horses who suffer from bladder stones to improve the water intake. However, nowadays we have much better ideas to increase the water intake, because it's not so strict correlation. So I'm more concerned to have low sodium intake than a high sodium intake, honestly, unless the horses has sufficient water. And there was always a lot of a debate in what way salt may induce gastric ulcers. And there's one paper, but they used a pure salt paste and gave it to the horses, and the stomach of the horses was more or less empty. They just provided over several horses very, very small amounts of hay, and they supplemented the salts over several hours by a salt paste. And then by this, you can induce gastric ulcers. However, my research group, we did also an experiment, and we edited a kind of salty pellet with 5% of sodium and some chloride, and we gave it in, or we mixed it under the typical feed. We mix it with grain, etc., and it was a very nice pellet. And we edited it in the morning and in the evening, and we spread the whole dosage over 2 or 3 meals. And then we looked to the stomach, and we couldn't find any negative consequences by adding this way of salt on the stomach. So we must make sure how we add the electrolytes. If we just put it as a paste on a more or less empty stomach, then it has negative consequences on the stomach. But if you use it by the routine feeding, there are no negative consequences. And then sometimes people add the electrolytes into the water. I think it's a recommendation from the US and Canada. I will never do this, because we always want to make sure that the horses like to drink water. And if the horses, even they are either not adapted or they do not really like to consume salty water, then you have the problem that the water intake is too low. And therefore, at least my recommendation is always to add it into the meal and use a palatable meal. You can use the mesh. It's and add some salt. Then I think it's really safe. But of course, it's just necessary if horses sweat. That's true. But I think the disadvantages, you can compensate for it. So honestly, I'm more happy that people add some more electrolytes, like you do in your countries, than in Germany. The people forget the salt story.
Can I ask, should I spend my money on a pre-made electrolyte, commercial bucket of something, or should I just go to the supermarket and buy regular table salt?
The optimal is to use table salt, but you must make sure that there is no iodine in the salt, just pure sodium and chlorine. And that is the easiest way to add electrolytes. And then you buy, let's say, a mesh or a muesli or a linseed, which is soaked, etc. And then you put some extra salt. So you can start, let's say, I always recommend 10 gram in the morning and 10 gram in the evening. And maybe when the horse is really performing on a high level and there's a lot of sweat in the summertime, then you can increase, let's say, in the morning 20 gram and in the evening also 20 gram. Then you are already sure on a very good basis. And if you have an endurance horse, they sometimes they lose much more sweat than 30, 40 liters, then of course you have to increase the amount of salt. But for most of the leisure horses, and even on a medium level of performance, if you add 20 gram in the morning and 20 gram salt in the evening, then it's fine.
Is there any time where you would recommend an electrolyte supplement that is the sodium chloride potassium when table salt is not sufficient, so to say?
Yeah, it is so that in endurance horses, a lot of the veterinarians recommend put an extra potassium intake. Maybe it's then a point when the horses refuse to eat after a strenuous exercise. So they're not able to eat, and they are dehydrated, and sometimes they have an impaction. Then, of course, it's necessary to add potassium. But these are really cases in endurance horses when they compete under very hot and conditions. Then of course potassium is also recommended, but in the typical horse, let's say in the North European countries, they do a little bit of exercise and after they stop riding, and so you provide, let's say, a combination of lucerne on and add some extra salt and have a kind of mesh, then I think it's not necessary to add extra potassium. In the moment when the horses consume sufficient amounts of forage, then there's a good potassium intake. But if the horses refuse to consume any feed at all, then of course we also recommend to add potassium. Yeah.
It's good to know. So as the last short topic, we just wanted you to elaborate a little bit about the quotes, because there is something that horse owners learn on the first course of equine nutrition, or the very basic knowledge of equine nutrition, is to always consider the calcium phosphorus. I think that's very well established. But are there any other that you think that there should be a better awareness around? I mean, we talked a little bit about the zinc copper ratio and that you might need to consider that, but when do you need to consider this?
This is my personal opinion. I think the quotes are completely overestimated. Yes, for calcium phosphorus, but horses accept a really broad range of a calcium phosphorus ratio, because if it's between, let's say, 1.1 up to 3 to 1, so that means 1.1 calcium up to 3 point calcium in relation to phosphorus, then it's fine for the horse. And many people, they read the labeling of a mineral supplement and they say, "Oh, have a look. The calcium phosphorus quote is not right," because they do not realize that you have to use the quote for the total ratio and not just for the supplements. That is, and therefore I don't care really too much about the quotes. And then there's a lot of debate of the quote of zinc and copper, because of a high zinc will have a negative consequence on the copper availability. However, for me, it's much better to look at the total intake, because a quote does not reflect, is there an over supplementation or an under supplementation. So you never know what you have, and therefore, at least for zinc and copper, I don't use this quote quote, although I know it, but I always check what is the total intake, and if I have a mismatch or an excessive intake of zinc or copper or whatever, although the quote is fine, then I try to reduce it. And the same is for the calcium phosphate. But probably I'm not the right person, but I don't care too much about the quote. If I do ration formulation, I never calculate the calcium phosphorus quote, because I know what are the ranges of the calcium intake, what are the ranges of the phosphorus intake. And also when the quote is fine, I say, okay, I have to adjust something. So
yeah.
I'm not really happy about the quotes, but it's maybe my personal opinion to that.
I think it's something that just got stuck with everyone that has ever read something about equinutrition, is that you have to be really careful about these. But I agree. I mean, as long as there is more calcium than there is phosphorus, you're good.
Yes, and horses tolerate a lot. Otherwise, we won't have any horses anymore.
Yeah.
It's complete, because the calcium metabolism is different between humans and horses. That is a big point. And the relationship between copper and zinc, or zinc and copper, I mean, you must feed extreme high amounts of zinc to have a negative effect on the copper availability. And I don't want to have this. And therefore, for me, the total intake is of greater interest than the quote.
Yeah.
I mean, the
Excellent.
total intake is fine, then the quote is also fine.
Yes. Good point. Thank you so much, Ingrid, for this episode. I hope that everyone listening to it is feel a little bit wiser about the minerals, vitamins and supplements. And it's a really interesting topic, I personally think. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for listening.
Tak fordi du lyttede med til Hestedyrlærerne. Hvis du kan lide det du hører, så læg en anmeldelse i din podcast-app, og glem ikke at fortælle dine kolleger om podcasten. Vi er snart tilbage med et nyt spændende afsnit af Hestedyrlærerne.